Lowen, Royden Lowen, and me. And strangely enough, I'm not a Lowen. I don't know how that happened. We believe that we have an interesting and challenging season in store. We'll reflect together on congregate living, reading the Bible prayerfully, Mennonite history, learning from our sisters and brothers in the Mennonite world community, and so much more. Today is the first in a series on feminism, what has changed. This theme began percolating in the committee last year, and Ruth Jantz, who was a member of the committee at the time, has been an invaluable partner in bringing this theme to life. We wish to invite you into a reflection on if, why, and how feminism has impacted the lives of women. In 2021, have our lives become less complex, safer, more equitable? Has the Christian faith community played a role in attaining more justice for women? As people of faith, how does our knowledge of continued injustices towards women affect our way of living, our way of being, and our way of relating to our neighbors and to people in positions of power? How do these changes give us hope, if at all? And how do they give us hope to continue activating for change? Our time together today will land us quickly into this reflection. And I'll now turn it over to Charles, who will introduce Diane Redsky. Welcome, Diane. We're truly honored to have you with us.
Thank you, Deborah, for giving me the privilege and pleasure of introducing my dear friend, Diane. You know, life, sometimes you have long friends and sometimes you have fast friends who you can become quite close with quickly and who can be lasting deep companions. I've been given a strict limit of 2.5 minutes for an introduction that I could easily stretch into a half hour. Much of it would be very personal and perhaps of less interest to you all. Diane is a remarkably candid person who gives generously and is disarmingly welcoming to any and all into her big world. But those personal reflections will have to wait for another day. Diane is currently the executive director of Mama We Chi Tata. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Diane. Mama We Center here in Winnipeg, Winnipeg's largest Indigenous social service agency. Mama We, translated from Ojibwe, means we all work together to help one another. It's community-based, community-led, Indigenous-driven, family resource center that is a leader in the community-based care for children, youth, and families in Winnipeg. From 2011 to 2015, Diane was project director for the National Task Force on Human Trafficking of Women and Girls in Canada. This role led her to work with experts in Canada and abroad to address the sexual exploitation and trafficking of Canadian women and girls. The honors she has already received in her young life are too numerous to recount today. They include the Order of Manitoba, Governor General's Awards in Commemoration of the Persons Case, the Senate of Canada Medal, and the 150 Manitoba Trailblazer Award from the Nellie McClung Foundation. Most precious to her, Diane is a proud mother of three and a kukum, that is a grandmother. She's a band member of Shoal Lake First Nation number 40. Okay, I can't resist. Diane is not a natural business person. She was fired from her first job as a clerk at a convenience store on the edge of a First Nation community. She kept giving the store's food to hungry kids who wandered into the store. So she's naturally gifted for the roles that she's played since. She is intelligent, bold, passionate, and she's smart as a whip. Diane is one of Manitoba's great leaders. Welcome to this part of our community, Diane. We are grateful that you're giving us your time and sharing some of your learning.
Oh, thank you, Charles. I so appreciate that and always so appreciate the time that we get to spend together and and the work that we get to accomplish together. So I hope our paths will cross in that way again, because it's I learned so much from you and you're a great representative of your community. And I've learned so much about the value, your shared values, and your commitment to the health and growth of all people. And so I want to thank all of you as well for the work that you're doing and coming together and meeting on Sundays to learn a little bit more about something that you may not know a lot about, or to have a different perspective of a particular issue. And feminism certainly is, we're at a critical juncture in the society at this point. And so thank you very much for that introduction and for the opportunity to be here. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the treaty territory of Treaty One, homeland of the Métis Nation, and the water that comes from Shoal Lake First Nation 40 into the city of Winnipeg. And those are really important aspects of acknowledging who I am and the values that I bring to the work that I do. So the topic that I'm talking about today is about sex trafficking of women and girls in Canada. This is one of the most worst human rights violation. It's the most extreme form of violence against women and girls. And I really want to make sure that people are, you're prepared for a presentation like this. There's no easy way to say some things. There's no easy way to talk about violence against women. And so if this is at any time just too much for you, it's okay to leave, and it's okay to go and talk to somebody. And in fact, that's encouraged even after this, to create an opportunity to debrief about the topic. So I've been working on the issue of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking for like 30 years now, and a lot has changed, and a lot has changed for the worse for women and girls. And so I'm going to talk about what these changes are. And there is a PowerPoint. And Deborah, are you able to put that on? And it is a PowerPoint that can be shared with among your group here. And I'm not going to go through every single slide because it's too much, but I wanted to give you some things to read about and to and hopefully I can come back and continue on and dive deeper on some of the slides that I'm presenting here today. So because it's important that everybody is as aware as possible when it comes to this particular issue, because it's 100% preventable. And that's certainly what we want to achieve, is a life where women and girls in our country, and particularly in our province and our city, are not for sale. And so that's certainly my end goal. So as part of the introduction, I was the director of a national task force that went across the country from coast to coast to coast to really dive deep with the communities within that area to understand what was happening in those jurisdictions around sex trafficking of women and girls in their area. And so we did launch a report, but before then, I was working for the Wichita Center, and we were already working on the issue of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking within the city of Winnipeg. And you'll see in some of the slides later on that Manitoba continues to be the leader in the country when it comes to this issue. And so that history goes back until the early 90s, and then bringing forward now, the Wichita Center operates the only rural healing lodge for child victims of sex trafficking. And so that is another unique thing that I bring to the table. And really, there should be rural healing lodges everywhere, as you'll see, because it is a real problem in our country. So the next slide. So these are key definitions, and I'm just going to go through a couple of them. The first one is the sex industry. And this is we call it the sex industry because we don't, because that is the reality. It's an industry where there's a whole bunch of people who benefit and profit off the sexual exploitation of women and girls. They could be legitimate businesses. So we have strip clubs, massage parlors, escort agencies, in our city and across the province. We have where there's lots of where there's venues are where sex is being bought and sold. And so there are a number of sectors that are involved in the sex industry. So we didn't want people to think that this is just about two consenting adults behind closed doors that aren't harming anybody. It's not that at all. There is a lot of people involved in the harm that is done, particularly to women and girls. This does happen to men and boys as well. I don't know a lot about it. And so my presentation is focused in on women and girls. The next one is there's a clear definition between the definition of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking that is really important. Sexual exploitation is when there is a woman or girl who is exchanging a sex act for something. And so there's nobody else involved other than her. So this is what you would see sometimes on Winnipeg streets when there is sexual exploitation happening, where there's not a third party involved. Sex trafficking, on the other hand, is when there's a pimp present. So a pimp is the same thing as a trafficker, where they are recruiting and luring, and they are part of the control, and they're the ones that are profiting directly and forcing her to be sexually exploited for the purposes of profit. And so that is the difference between sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, and people and women and girls can go in between them. So when a trafficker dumps a girl, she will have no choice but to be sexually exploited to make ends meet. And then a trafficker will come into her life again, probably a different one. And then she's back to being controlled again. And so sexual exploitation and sex trafficking women can go back and forth with that. Experiential women and girls, those are survivors, Indigenous, migrant. Those are the communities that are impacted the most from sex trafficking. And traffickers are pimps. That's just another description for them. It's a legal description for the crime that they're committing, because we have legislation on it now. And then the demand and the buyers are those that are buying women and girls for sex. They're primarily men, 99% of the time. And they're the ones that are really driving the supply that creates victims of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. So you'll see as I get to some of the slides around how do we stop this? One way is to address the demand. And then of course, offenders that have a unique category, because anybody who is sexually abusing a child under the age of 18 as an offender. And oftentimes we have minimized that language which calling them a John and a child prostitute. And those are, words that actually shouldn't even be together at all, because this is a child who is being victimized and abused and there's an offender present. And so we're very clear on anybody under the age of 18 cannot give consent, and that is abuse. And so that's really critically important in the work that we're doing. Next slide. Thank you. So this is the legal definition of human trafficking. And I just want to highlight just a couple things from here. So Canada signed on to an international protocol called the Plumero Protocol. So we're connected to a whole bunch of other countries that are trying to end human trafficking within their country. There's two ways. There's forced labor, and there's sexual exploitation, and there's also the buying and selling of organs, which is also included in the definition of human trafficking. And in Canada, we've only had a law on our books that you can't buy and sell people for the purposes of profit, which is a definition under the human trafficking legislation, since 2005. So this is actually still a relatively new law, and it's still gaining momentum on the law community enforcing this piece of legislation. And so we are we're ahead in many countries, but we're still, have a long way to go with really doing the full enforcement of human trafficking in our country, because it is still not known enough and not applied enough as it relates to what's happens in the court system. And you'll see that in my other slide of how many cases we've actually prosecuted in Canada. So there's a whole bunch of work being done across the country. The RCMP have a national coordination center. Locally here, we have the Joy Smith Foundation that is doing incredible work with trying to raise awareness nationally on the issue, as well as our organization at the Mon Wichita Center, but many, many others that are involved into looking at the service piece of it. And so the definition of human trafficking does require a third person, does require a pimp to be present in order that is committing an offense. Next slide. So some common myths is that human trafficking happens only with people coming into Canada. And in fact, that's not the truth. Most of the human trafficking that happens in Canada is against women and is for the purposes of sexual exploitation. And so it is not only, it's a crime that happens to Canadians, by Canadians, and in Canada. And that is 90% of the time. That is the case. So it does happen where people are coming into Canada and being brought into Canada. There was just a case within the last month where there was a man charged with adopting children from other countries, bringing them into Canada, and then sexually abusing them and trafficking them when they get here. And so that is another way in which children are being brought into Canada for the purposes of harming. So they're using the legal adoptions to gain access to very vulnerable children. And then human trafficking is about movement over borders. And that, trafficking is about the control and the form of exploitation and the profit. So it actually has nothing to do with movement. However, movement is a part of the control that traffickers will have over a victim when they are trying to keep them always in an unsafe predicament. And human trafficking is the same as human smuggling. That is very, very different. The key difference between the two is that with smuggling, you're paying a fee to enter Canada, and then when you get here, you're free to go. Human trafficking, on the other hand, when you enter Canada, you're not free to go. You're still controlled by a trafficker the entire time. Next slide. So this is the national task force that I was a part of, and it's on the Mon Wichita Center website. Really encourage you to get to know the recommendations. And so it was a pretty extensive deep dive across the country. And so it's a good piece of work. Next slide. So this is an important slide because this talks about what does sex trafficking look like? So who is being trafficked are Canadians and people coming in from other countries. Who are the criminals that are doing, who's involved in making this a criminal reality for women is that there's two distinct groups in sex trafficking. There's always the supply and the demand, just the same business principles as all other business principles, supply and demand. There's the business part of it, which that's where the traffickers are. So they're also the same. They're also called pimps or managers. And then there is the consumer side, which often are called the Johns. And they're the ones that are buying women for the purposes of sexual exploitation. And they're buying children for the purposes of sexually abusing them. And so they're called Johns. They're also called the demand. I have other words that I shouldn't be using right now to call them. But they are a real part of the problem because they are the ones that are driving the supply for to victimize women and girls. And so, wouldn't it be great if there was, all the demand said, we're not buying women and girls anymore, then that would dry up the supply. And so that's why the addressing the demand is a really key part of the solution moving forward. Next one. Next slide. So this next slide is, thank you. So how does this happen? What does it look like? What does sex trafficking look like? And there's really three categories to it. There's the recruitment, the control, and then it ends at some point. It does end for women and girls. And so the recruitment and luring is very organized, methodical. It's targeted towards children and teens because a trafficker can make more money from for selling a child or a teenager than they do an adult woman. And so another reason why they target children and teens is because it's easier. Children and teens are very impressionable. It's oftentimes that traffickers will go anywhere where there are not a lot of adults around, but a lot of kids around. So they are in shopping malls, they go to social events, bus stations, it happens online, simply walking down the street to go to school from other peers who are being sexually exploited. Sometimes your own family, if you have multiple generations of families who have been victimized repeatedly throughout generations. We have had children involved in the child welfare system that live in group homes. There's usually the promise of a better life. We had one survivor who shared with us that she was actually recruited at church. And so traffickers will go and become part of wherever to gain access to vulnerable young people. And because it pays off, and you'll see how that pays off, but it's rooted in greed. And that's why they target children and teens. And then once the recruitment and luring starts, and this could be anything from recruited online or recruited in any one of those environments, that they will be the happy party person who will want to convince them that you don't have to listen to your parents because I'll take care of you and I'll take you, I'll buy you, go and buy you some clothes and some nails, I'll buy you alcohol and drugs and, you know, and I will listen to you. Your parents don't understand you, but I understand you. And so those are all of the messages young teenagers are getting. And it is critically important that we also understand what happened to her when what created that vulnerability for her in the first place. And I'm just going to just take a step back for a second and ask you to think of a continuum where, you know, the first part of a young girl's life, if there is any kind of, and this is a common story, but not the only way, if there was something that happened in her life at the very beginning that traumatized her, it could be any kind of trauma, whether it's sexual trauma, emotional trauma, physical trauma. So something happened when they were little that created some vulnerability. So when she's 11 or 12, and when we did the national task force, there are certain parts of the country where victims were as young as 10 that were being recruited and lured. And so the average age right now is 13 and getting younger. When I first started 30 years ago, the average age was 17 and then moved down to 16 and really took a leap down to 13, where it is right now and getting younger. So a girl hearing that all of these like glorified, you know, you don't need your parents and come party with me. That is how they're being recruited and learned. Or they could be at a shopping mall and somebody comes up and says, you need to be a model. And I know how to get you jobs at modeling. And so there's a lot of really manipulation that happens during the recruitment and luring that gets her to the point where she trusts that individual. And then at some point, I call it where the shoe drops. And now the control kicks in. And usually traffickers are saying, look, I bought you your drugs, your alcohol, your clothes, your this, your that. And now you have to pay me back. And the way you're going to pay me back is you're going to sleep with my friend. You're going to have sex with my friend. And then that's usually how that will escalate into now she has a quota that she has to meet. And so that is the part. I'm going to go back to that continuum. So when she's 13 and she's vulnerable, she's listening to all of those key messages. And then it's during that time where she is controlled, usually between 13 and into her early 20s, where she is being completely controlled by a trafficker. Then usually around in their 20s, 25-ish, they're of no value to a trafficker anymore because the demand will only buy ones under that look young, under the age of 18. And so even when they're in their early 20s, they go to look younger. And so by the time they're 25, they can't look younger anymore. So they're not of value to a trafficker anymore because they're not making enough money. And so at 25, five things can happen to her. The first one is that she can stay with the trafficker, and this happens often, where she now works for the trafficker, but in a different way. And they call them usually the bottom bitch of the group, because a trafficker will not just have one. They'll have four or five different ones that they are controlling. And so they will become part of the running of the business. So they're the ones shopping, buying clothes, feeding, making supper, collecting the money. So they're doing a number of errands, but they're working for the trafficker, but they are no longer being sexually exploited anymore. And so that's one thing that can happen when they're 25. The second thing that can happen when they're 25 is that, or sooner, is that traffickers will always have an exit fee. So they'll say, look, if you want to go, go, but you're going to have to pay me anywhere between, and we met families that paid $10,000 and $150,000 to get their daughter back. And so the traffickers justify it as, I've been paying her rent, her clothes, her food, you know, this whole time, and now you have to pay me back. So families have paid money to get their daughters back. So the third thing that can happen is that they end up in the survival sex industry. And that is, so if you're 25 and you've been recruited and controlled since you were 13 years of age, many women are completely victimized at that point. They are 100% most likely have a criminal record. They have been financially exploited as well by traffickers. They are drug addicted. They have a lot of mental health because of the trauma that has been done to their bodies. And so they are really feel that they have no value in at all. And so the survival sex industry is all that they can do. And so we see many of these women that will be on streets or online that are really living day to day, trying to get enough to pay the rent or trying to get enough to eat that day. And so because this is all they feel that they're worth only to be sexually exploited. And so the survival sex industry is really thriving in our country because there's so many victims now that are in that survival sex industry. The fourth thing that can happen is that if it hasn't happened already, we lose many women and girls to violence. And so they're either murdered or they commit suicide. And that is just a sad part of the reality of how they're coping with the trauma and the exposure to violence that they are exposed to as a result of being driven by profit. And then the last thing, or the fifth thing, and it can be one of five or a combination of a couple of them, is that they can begin their very long journey to healing, where at 25 or at some point along their journey, they just go, that's it. They have a window of opportunity and they start the long journey of rebuilding their lives. And so that is, we have a whole bunch of survivor leaders in our province who have lots of experience talking about their what happened to them during that period of time, being part of the solution. And now, you know, half of them, we have about 50% of our staff that work in our Rural Healing Lodge are survivors. And that is a powerful way to help young people, but it's also a powerful way in which it helps her on her healing journey. And so, and her healing journey is forever. Then at, you know, there are women who do rebuild their lives, and the sad part of, and the most tragic part for victims of sex trafficking is that when they get to the end of their life, like they become 40, 50 years old, because of the trauma done to their bodies, they end up dying young. So many will not make it to 60 years of age because, again, of the just the repeated trauma done to their bodies. and they end up with terminal illnesses that are directly related to that trauma and to what had happened to them when they were young. And so that, you know, when you look at the continuum, that even though we're looking at sex trafficking while it's happening, there is a before part and there is an after part that is really critically important to understand, because it relates it to the solutions. So then how does it happen? So the recruitment and luring is when she's 13, as young as 10, but they are targeting towards children and teens. Then the shoe drops. So the goal is about control. They have to be able, traffickers have to be able to control their victims, because they want, it's all rooted in greed. And so they control in a whole bunch of variety of ways. They're often tattooed because they become property of a trafficker. They are moved every 10 days because they got to keep them in constant chaos. However, there are a whole bunch we know that exist, where there are teenagers living at home and being trafficked, and everybody missing it in their lives. So where there's more and more young people that are living at home under their parents' roof and still being trafficked. So there is you know, a whole variety of ways in which traffickers control. You have traffickers who are, you know, the nice ones, the Romeo type traffickers, and then you have what are all called guerrilla traffickers, who are very extremely violent, and then everything in between. So there's all different ways in which they're controlled, but it's all about keeping her small so she is powerless, invisible, and alone. And oftentimes victims will trauma bond with their traffickers, so they will fall in love with them. And it's important to understand, trauma bonding is a way survivors cope with the trauma. So they have to justify it in their own heads that they know this is wrong. They know they're being impacted. They know all of this stuff, but they're powerless. And so how do you rectify that in your own being, is that they will justify it and think that I love him. This will be better. I'm helping him. You know, we're a team. We're a family. And so those are all the messages that are also being told. And so trauma bonds with trafficker makes it really difficult for outreach workers and for community organizations who are reaching out to victims and trying to get them out of the situation they're in. So there's a real art to being able to be on the front lines to do that. And so trauma bonding with a trafficker is a reality. So then, like I said, there is a, I'm just going to actually read something. I don't usually do this, but I'm going to read something from a book that it's called Invisible Chains. It was, actually, I can send you a list of readings if you are want to learn more about this issue, but it's a 2010 book from Benjamin called Invisible Chains. And this paragraph really describes that recruitment and luring and that control that traffickers do. And so the quote is, and this is a quote from a survivor, from a trafficker. "You'll start to dress her, think for her, own her. If you and your victim are sexually active, slow it down. After sex, take her for shopping for one item. Hair and nails is fine. She'll develop a feeling of accomplishment. The shopping after a month will be replaced with cash. The lovemaking turns into raw sex. She'll start to crave the intimacy and be willing to get back into your good graces. After you have broken her spirit, she has no sense of self-value. Now, pimp, put a price tag on the item you have manufactured." And so in that book, he was actually referring to a instruction manual for pimps that is available online on eBay for $300. So it's a whole how-to book on how to control, how to recruit, lure, and control and profit off the sexual exploitation of women and girls. And so that is another problem of having so much information available online and for free. There's even some that are free. You don't even have to pay the $300 for that. So again, as I said, in that continuum, There's escape or rescue. So it does end at some point, and usually in their early 20s. And some situations where she had a window of opportunity because the trafficker was arrested. The family paid an exit fee, that law enforcement did a prostitution raid or a bust, or a community outreach program continued to reach out to her, you know, once, twice, and started building a relationship with her. And she felt confident that she had the resources in order to leave and leave for good. And so it is, so it does end at some point, but that only ends in a healing journey that lasts for the rest of her life. That's when that starts happening. Next slide. And this is just, again, a quick, just some highlights that risk factor is a girl, recruitment age 13, as I said, and that this is the financially gaining. So a trafficker can financially can profit off one girl, $280,000 a year. And so this is highly motivated in money, cash money. And so it is women and girls who are often who are impacted in Canada are targeted towards marginalized women and girls. This is really racism, sexism, and classism at its very worst. And we asked survivors as we went across the country in Canada and said, when you're being trafficked as a child and you were either maybe living at home, like where were all the adults? Like how did all the adults miss everything? So can you tell us what, which systems did you interact with the most when you were being trafficked as a child? And the number one was school. They all went to school. And so there's huge opportunity for schools to be on board, child welfare. So they were in a group home, and three, a community organization. So it could have been a youth organization, could have been even a church group. And so these are areas where we need to concentrate and saturate all of those, areas where young people are with information on how to protect themselves from traffickers, because they're just lurking and waiting, and they'll be patient because they're motivated by the profit that they're making. Next slide. And so survivor-led initiatives, you'll see that, look at, there's only 455 cases since 2005. So we, in our report, we talk about, we've done the math on the pain and suffering, the loss of earnings, and just the impact to society because of too many people and too many systems and not enough people know what's going on to do something to end this. And of course, the inconsistent provincial child protection policies in some of our provinces in the country, it's only goes up to 16. We live in Manitoba and our child protection is 18, so we're not in that same situation. Next slide. And this is in particular, just go through the next slides a little faster. So why are Indigenous women and girls targeted? You know, and I hope that this is one area. I know Charles is one of our greatest allies with education and understanding more about what creates vulnerability for Indigenous people. And so they're all pretty consistent with this slide. And then the next slide. When we did a survey of survivors who are Indigenous survivors, this is, you know, the reality. So Indigenous survivors would experience more trauma, more violence than non-Indigenous. And again, those are those harmful stereotypes that Indigenous women love violence. We like being hit and abused, and that's the purpose we serve. And so there's those really harmful stereotypes are really impacting Indigenous women and girls more. Next slide. And this is again more about the uniqueness about Indigenous women and girls. Next slide. And the National Task Force, this is what we learned across the country. You know, we suffer more extreme violence. We're criminalized more often as it relates to prostitution-related offenses. And I'll get into that in a minute. Next slide. So are we getting any better in Canada? Absolutely not. This is getting worse. The girls are getting younger and younger. As I said, as young as 10, there was a 10-year-old in Thunder Bay that we learned about, and they're, you know, the average age being 16. Our home for, we have actually two resources in Winnipeg. One is a safe house. The other one is a rural healing lodge for child victims. And the average age there is 14 that is coming into our place where they're coming in for to start their healing journey from the victimization that they have already experienced from a trafficker. And so they're getting younger and younger. Traffickers are also becoming more subtle. So it's not cool to say pimp anymore. They are now posing as boyfriends. So they're really being even more sneaky. It's not, even the pimp culture is not, that's not cool anymore. So they're finding other ways to define and describe themselves and to gain access and build trust with vulnerable women and girls. And so either a boyfriend or a father or a daddy. And so there is, that's becoming more and more of a huge problem where they're just becoming part of, it's harder to detect them as it was before. Trafficking is becoming less visible because it's going online. And that is really, it's just becoming harder and harder because it's hard to tell who is posting the ad. Other than, you know, children being advertised, there is, you know, just recently, again, Pornhub was called out on because they had about 10% of what was online is from our minors that were being sexually abused, you know, so you're witnessing a crime occurring. So it's not even, that's why we also shouldn't be calling it child pornography, because it's a child crime scene. That's the right way to describe it. So trafficking is becoming more profitable for more people, without a doubt. Before Backpage was closed, they were making $4 million a month, based on the advertising of women and girls for the purposes of sexual exploitation. And so it is, it's hugely profitable across the board, even hotels and cab drivers, a whole bunch of people play a role in the sexual exploitation and profiting and being a part of the victimization of women and girls. Next slide. So the National Task Force, and certainly this is something I strongly believe in, is that we are, true equality for women and girls will not be achieved until all forms of violence, including sexual exploitation and trafficking, are eradicated. So that's the answer. When women are have an equitable place at the table, that's when things will change. Next slide. This national anti-trafficking strategy is actually based on the Manitoba strategy. And it is a recommendation that the National Task Force said, this is the answer. These are the practical ways you can end sex trafficking in your province, in your city, in your municipality, across the country. And so again, I refer you to our website to read this report. So there is lots of, and the next slide is these are the 34 recommendations in their four categories: change systems, support women and girls, build awareness, and collective action. Because it's not just a government problem, it's not just a policing issue. It really is going to take money, and it's going to take a collaboration of everybody to be able to address and end this, because it is 100% preventable. And next slide. These are the promising practices across the country. There's lots of innovation happening like across the country. And these are just some highlights. And again, you know, there's a deeper dive in our report online. There's a, you know, you can, the Joy Smith Foundation also keeps a really good list of promising practices across the country of organizations doing really good work in a collaborative way with policing, with governments, with philanthropy, with community-based organizations, and most importantly, with survivors. Next slide. So this is what happens in Manitoba. I thought you'd want to see some action here in Manitoba. And so Manitoba is a province that knows more about sexual exploitation and sex trafficking in our country, because we've invested money into a sexual exploitation strategy. So we have, Manitoba has had the only strategy in Canada since really 2000 to 2016. And during that period of time, Manitoba invested $11 million. We're now at $11 million annually into ending sexual exploitation and sex trafficking in our province. And Ontario, they in 2016 were the second province that launched a provincial strategy in theirs, but it's nowhere near our strategy. It's $75 million over 5 years. And with their population base, they would have needed to do, you know, way more than that. I think it's like 25% of their population that they have. However, they're doing something, and that's what's important. So currently today, we only have two provinces in our country that have a provincial strategy to do targeted investments on prevention, intervention, helping women rebuild their lives, education and training, and really working at ending this most extreme form of violence against women and girls. And so Manitoba has led much of that work across the country. We are the gold star, you know, as it relates to services and just how the continuum. We invest that $11 million wisely throughout the system. So that strategy is called Tricia's Trust. And that is in memory of a young person. She was 15 years old, a sexually exploited youth controlled by a trafficker. Everybody missed it. And it resulted in her death. And so the Manitoba strategy is in honor of Tricia Owen, and reminds us that we have to continue to be vigilant. We have to continue to change, because sex trafficking and sexual exploitation change constantly, just like businesses do. You adapt to your market, you adapt to the demand. And so it is really critically important that we don't forget why we're doing this work. And so it's in memory of Tricia Owen. And so it continues to be a strategy that happens today. The next slide. This is also important, is that oftentimes the issue between sex trafficking and prostitution come up together and they bump heads. And we're kind of in that situation now. So those of you that may have heard, last month, the city of Winnipeg was going to make it easier for massage parlors, where there are common menus. That's where, you know, sex is bought and sold, where women are forced to be there. They're well known for that, where the city wanted to make it easier for massage parlors to be set up in the city of Winnipeg. And so I had appeared before the executive committee of the city of Winnipeg, and I called them out on being a pimp, because the city of Winnipeg, if you profit off the sexual exploitation of women and girls, you're no different than a pimp. And so so that is something we're changing. There's a group of us that want to make Winnipeg the only city in Canada that does not have massage parlors, that does not have a bylaw that makes it okay that massage parlors exist. And so, you know, and I would even go as far to include strip clubs and escort agencies, because that's only normalizing violence. And so the intersection between prostitution and sex trafficking, there's no way around it. And there is oftentimes a pushback from the pro-prostitution groups that says, this is my body, my right. I would agree with, you can do whatever you want with your body. However, we don't create laws that benefit only just a few when they're 90% are being victimized. And so that is really the polarization that happens between prostitution and sex trafficking. And so I wanted to ensure that, because as you start your education on this and you dive deeper, you are going to run into this intersection of prostitution and sex trafficking. And so I wanted to make sure you are aware of being prepared for that. Next slide. And so this is how we, in terms of the National Task Force on that, the connection between prostitution and sex trafficking is that, you know, we can't criminalize those who are being victimized. We have to go after the demand. And so Winnipeg also is very unique. We have the Winnipeg Police has a counter-sexual exploitation unit that is dedicated to addressing the demand. So going after those men who are buying children and women buying them for the purposes of abusing or for sex acts. And that we are reaching out and supporting women and girls and helping them. So if you have no choice and you're being sexually exploited because you need money to pay the rent, or if you don't have enough food on the table for your kids, why don't we help you find money for food and to pay the rent instead of creating the vulnerability for women to be out there that are being exposed to the demand. And so that is one way in which we see. And so in Winnipeg, we have not arrested a woman in Winnipeg since 2013, because the Winnipeg Police, with the help of the community, are educated and recognize these are women in need of who need service, not a criminal record. And so that is another really important distinction to how Winnipeg as well is very unique in Canada. And so next slide. And so this just goes more into the Bill C-36 that talks about, so we were able to pull off in Canada that don't charge women, go after the demand. So there's a criminalization for the purposes of sex. So in Winnipeg, before Bill C-36 in 2016, that happened, we had a bill that said don't charge women, but go after the demand. And since in Winnipeg, before Bill C-36, they would charge around 40, you know, around 40 men a year. And now, over the years, we're up to like a few hundred are being charged annually in the city of Winnipeg now, because, again, our police recognize that if you go after the demand, hopefully that will address the supply. And then next slide. This just goes into it a little bit more about what the police have done and with the community as well. And then the last slide is, there's another one. So this is more about what the community is doing and what we have available here in Winnipeg, where there is a whole community that is over 50 organizations meet monthly, where there's an education program. There is the prostitution diversion camps, which normally would be for women who are charged with prostitution. They are now voluntary and monthly, where they used to be mandated because you had a criminal record and done twice a year. So now, because there's so much resources coming in from the John schools that they can afford now to offer the camps monthly. There's 24-hour outreach. And so lots of things are happening within our city and within our province. Although I would say we can't keep up as well with that. There's still a problem with the demand and there's still a problem with poverty. And until women have enough money to make ends meet, they will need to do things to get money to make ends meet. And so it's up to us, I believe, as a society to ensure that we're creating a safety net that is equitable for everybody. And guaranteed livable income is one way in which to get there. So then next slide. And then this is a campaign we did in partnership with the CFL and the Grey Cup. Whatever year that was, it was cold, I remember. So it was, again, another campaign that we did locally here in Winnipeg. Next slide. And so this is the inspiration moving forward. Again, tons of work being done across the country, tons of work that we need to do still, you know, and again, it takes a whole community. It takes all sectors working together. And then last slide, or second last slide. So this is what you can do. You can learn more about it. You can speak up about it, challenge it, stop it, change it. Like everybody has an individual, has their individual power to be part of the solution. This one situation I had where actually a young man in Nova Scotia emailed me and said he learned as a result of learning more about it. He said he stopped going to strip clubs and buying magazines that were of sexually of women who are being sexually exploited. And so said he had no idea how his individual buying those things and going to those venues was part of the problem. And so he just stopped doing it and told his friends to stop doing it. And so it again, when we have more awareness and we know the impact or the unintended consequences of doing something, that we can be part of the solution. And so that's just the power of an individual. And then, you know, to broaden that out, there's an incredible opportunity for that. And then the last slide is a slide from a survivor who I asked for some assistance. If, you know, as I'm going out, what do you want people to know? And for her, it was just try hard not to give up on us like everyone else in the world has. And so that is an incredible, powerful quote that certainly has motivated me. And I really hope it motivates you to learn more and help us build a safer society where women and girls are not for sale. Miigwech. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And there's a few more minutes for questions. And I'll turn it back to Deborah, I think, is going to be doing the questions.
Thank you, Diane. I feel like I don't have very many words right now. This was just a very powerful presentation and leaves me with a really big challenge. So we do have time for questions, and I would invite anyone who has a question or a comment to do that now. Let me see. We have about 15 minutes, so we have some time. So anyone who has questions, please go ahead.
I do have a question. Thank you very much, Diane. That was extremely moving. My question has to do with the mysteries of the way in which legal systems intersect in Canada, the provincial versus the federal. I'm aware of a situation where a predator has been prosecuted and imprisoned, and we discovered that this particular predator was granted release by a judge, which moved the sentencing out of the federal jurisdiction back into the provincial, and now he's on the streets, and the young woman that he assaulted is really quite frightened, unnecessarily so. And the federal authorities who were in touch with the woman's family were not allowed to give any kind of detail whatsoever on the basis of the decision that was made by the provincial judge who granted the person bail and so on. So I'm just wondering whether there's sometimes a conflict between the several branches of law.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a huge problem. Even with the human trafficking legislation that happened, that was started in 2005, which it became an indictable offense. So for example, in an indictable offense is very, very serious. So it's in the same category as murder and, you know, all extreme form of violence. So human trafficking lies there. And then that's federal legislation. The provincial legislation has prostitution related offenses. So if you are caught communicating for the purposes of prostitution, that is a summary offense. And a summary offense is in the same category as jaywalking. So people say, why don't you produce names and give out names and stuff? And they, so the response I get is, well, we don't do that for people who jaywalk. So we're not doing it for people who are charged with prostitution related offenses. But there is a huge, it interferes with that dynamic, but it's also done in a positive way too, because police sometimes will not have enough power because there's not enough evidence to prove an indictable offense for human trafficking. So they will use the prostitution related offenses, even just to separate a trafficker or a pimp from her, even just for a period of time. And so that's where it's an advantage to use the provincial legislation for that. But that being said, with where victims are in this whole situation, there is, in fact, we have a chapter within our national task force report that's talking about just what you're raising is the difference between the federal and provincial legislation and how challenging that that is. And at the end of the day, there's no benefit, there's no incentive for victims to come forward at all. Like, they get nothing out of it. They end up being the ones on trial. And then we had also highlighted, and I've trained twice now, judges on this particular issue. And I'll tell you, there's still a whole bunch of old school thinking of, well, why didn't she just close her legs? Why didn't she, you know, she put herself out there. There's, you know, he's the victim, she's not. And so we really have some work to do when it comes to the legal system overall, because even all sexual violence toward, like all of them, is really minimal when it goes to, when you just look at the demand and the reality and how many convictions there are is incredibly low versus the actual reality of what happens. And that's the same goes for human trafficking. And there is the most anybody has received in Canada is 8 years for human trafficking. And so by the time you go to court, you know, and that whole process can be up to 5 years of her retelling her story the entire time. There's no incentive for her. She gets nothing out of it. And in fact, it only re-triggers her. It only just re-victimizes her all over again. And so it's a real problem. That being said, Manitoba has also done a couple of things to address that challenge between the federal and provincial. We have it's called the Human Trafficking Act, and it's a provincial legislation. It's the only one that exists in Canada, where the province has taken it a step further to complement human trafficking legislation. So that gives Manitoba more judicial power to interfere when the indictable offense for the federal crime is just too much, because the evidence you need is like this much to prove an indictable offense. And so the province has stepped in and is not only using the prostitution related offenses, but created a whole unique Human Trafficking Act that gives them more power and gives actually more families power. So when there is a parent who has a child or even a young adult who is a victim of who is being controlled by a pimp, can secure a protection order on behalf of that other person very easily. So that it becomes a crime if that trafficker is anywhere near that victim, it can be criminalized. And so we are fining people, and people are starting to spend jail time when they are not abiding by a protection order as a result of the human trafficking legislation. So, you know, Manitoba has figured out how to use it, you know, wisely and address some of that, the challenges with the jurisdiction. But there's a huge problem in Canada, even just, you know, the low conviction rates is, you know, we have a long way to go to educating the judicial system on how to maximize and really create the incentive for more victims to come forward. Because most women are just like, I just want to get out of here. I don't want to see him again. I just want to rebuild my life. Like, I'm done. And so we need to give them some kind of incentive. So some of these really, you know, horrible people are getting their time and figuring out what went wrong in their lives, so that they felt that that was okay. And so they need to, and victims need justice. So I hope, and that's, you know, with, I hope our, there isn't some efforts made, but it's slow in the justice system to make any change.
Is there anyone in your...
Thank you. Thank you, Diane. Sorry, John, we have two more questions. If that's okay, we'll move. And maybe you can follow up the conversation with Diane later. But I'd like to address, have Michelle and then John both have a question. And I think that will take us to the end of the hour.
Thanks. Thank you, Diane, so much for joining us today. I'm so honored that you spent your time with us. My questions might be of value to frontline workers. I would be a frontline worker. I'm a social worker that works in the area of supporting families with children with disabilities. So unfortunately, oh, this is so emotional. Unfortunately, I have supported young girls. And there's no law, Diane's not lying when the girls are 11 years old and being recruited. It's such a hard spot to be in because you're competing with what the girls are attracted to, what they're looking, what, you know, where they're meet, where a need is being met for them. So I have two questions. One being, if someone is aware of a girl at risk, and you know, we have our teams of the different things, CFS and the school, and you know, I'm on the disability part, and we have those teams, but that kind of expertise that you have, is there so this is my first question, is there a way to involve someone who has that specialized knowledge of the system that you've explained, the trafficking system that you've explained to and opened our eyes to today? Mm-hmm. And secondly, you did a great job of the explaining what the life cycle is for the girls and women. I would love to hear more about what the traffickers look like what age are they, the 16-year-old boyfriend?
Yeah,
what I'm curious about.
Yeah, sadly they're not, although that does happen. And again, and depending on where you are in the country, but I would say certainly in Winnipeg, our traffickers are a combination of organized crime, so they are very organized, and this is, there's we just had three situations last year where we interrupted girls coming from Montreal on their way to Calgary. And so that's the organized part of it. And then I would say that the majority of the perpetrators and offenders who are doing the recruiting and luring are newcomers. In fact, that's our reality here, but that's in Winnipeg, but it's all different wherever you are. And it's less organized. So they may have a cousin in Calgary. And so where they're trading girls from one to the other, from Winnipeg to Calgary and back. And then maybe they have another relative in Toronto or Montreal. And it's really kind of loosey-goosey like that. There really isn't it's not as organized. And we also have some individual men who live in their homes and will open it up and say, sometimes it'll start with, you're cleaning my house, to now you're, you know, I'll give you $20 to have sex with my friend and me, and, you know, et cetera. And so there is, that's another reality of who is doing the victimization here and profiting off the sexual exploitation. So there is, and then the buyers are really have shifted, that they've always usually typically been people who are white, middle to upper class, and don't live in the neighborhood. And so, but now it really has become, and I've asked survivors, is this just like a few bad men in Winnipeg that are just, you know, buying you all the time, or and victimizing you all the time? Or is this like a whole bunch? And they're like, no, it's a whole bunch. Like, it's pretty normalized. And when I do outreach with our team a few times a year, and we go throughout the North End at nighttime, after midnight, you know, and sometimes between 10 and midnight, it lights up in the North End. You got all these fancy cars that are, they're not there during the day, and they're certainly not working there. That is the reality of you just even look at. So that's who the demand is. It's kind of like everybody. It's shifted into, it's so normalized now that it just, even sometimes people say, what do I do if I see a girl on the street corner and I suspect that she's being sexually exploited or she's out there selling sex and we know she's under 18? I'm like, call 911. Like, it's a crime. Like, there is, she needs, and we have a police, we've done lots of work with our policing where they're a lot more educated. And when our outreach team is calling, they have a special team out at the same time. So there is that coordination that happens. So that is, and what we've learned as well, it depends on where you are again across the country, but traffickers sometimes will have the same story as a victim, you know, where they were young and something happened and, you know, their values got messed up along the way. And so they would have a similar story, but then others are just, it's just rooted in bad, they're bad business people, you know, with bad values on how to make money. And many participate that. We have many hotels that run strip clubs. All women, all survivors I've talked to, they have been trafficked in an escort agency and or strip club and or massage parlor. And so it's just become normalized violence. And we're trying to create awareness that we're just normalizing, victimizing women by paying for it. That doesn't make it right. So I hope I answered all of your questions.
Thank you, Diane. One more question. We really try to be on time, but that's okay. It looks like people are interested. So let's do the last question, which is from Jonathan Sears. Can you say more about demand reducing initiatives and activities and approaches?
Yeah, so our task force report talks about starting young with boys. Because the number one addiction for boys 9 to 12 years old is pornography. And so that's another part of the problem, is that our young boys are learning way too young about what is a relationship. And the way pornography works is you can start off watching low violence, but in order to get the same kind of thrill, you have to up the violence. So by the time they're 12, they're watching really extremely violent pornography. And then they think that is a relationship. And it's learning how to objectify women, that women can be bought and sold. And so there is, our task force report talks about making huge investments into men and boys, and starting boys really young and addressing that pornography problem that we're having in our country, with young boys having anybody can watch it. Like, it's, you know, you can watch it off your phone even. So it's really difficult for parents to be ahead of the game there. And then around the demand, we know that there are two things that will address the demand. You make their names public and you criminalize. And that is another way, and creating education and awareness. Because like I said, with that young man who said, I'm never going into a strip club again, because now I know, you know, the reality is that she's forced to be there. It just is not the same show anymore that I'm watching, because I'm more educated. And so the more and more men and boys as well get educated and become allies, that's when we're going to see a real shift. And so there are, again, I can send a reader's list. There's innovation across our country, but the United States is also doing a whole bunch of innovation in their country on addressing the demand and how to create an environment where the demand now becomes part of the solution. And because that is critically important as well. And we're really, a lot of this is that we've been brainwashed by the sex industry to think that this is just two consenting adults behind closed doors where nobody is being hurt. And that is so wrong. We have an opportunity to be part of the solution here, and we need everybody, including those who are and have some experience with being a part of the problem. And so there's huge opportunity, and it's going to take all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Diane. I'm sure that there are more more questions and more comments that could be shared. Thank you so much. And thank you also for sharing the website and the PowerPoint, which we can all refer to gain more information and more education. And this is a great way to start our little mini series on feminism, what has changed. And I, on the part of our congregation, I wish you well and blessings in your continued work, which is so important. So thank you, and have a great Sunday, everyone. And we'll see you, some of you, next week. Thanks, Diane. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much again, everyone. I appreciate everybody being here. Thank you. Bye, Charles. I'll see you again.
You bet. Soon, I hope.